possibly about more fundamental political and social changes. And these ideals really helped inspire Novikov as a publisher and a journalist. And now more than ever, he saw his work as awakening people to this voice of truth that he now heard, spiritual, moral, ethical. And he began in 1777 to publish a truly remarkable journal, which was called Morning Light. This was like nothing Russia had ever seen before, not a light, humorous, satirical journal, not one that took the time to flatter the ruler, but a serious philosophical and moral journal whose goal was to promote virtue through openly moralistic writings, to chastise what they called weakness, imperfection, and vice. And the message was clear and profound and potentially quite subversive. For example, in the introductory editorial that Novikov wrote, which was called appropriately, since it was the main theme of all these writings, on the dignity of man, and much of the journal echoed the same message, he argued that human beings, contrary to the claims of the church, are not miserable fallen creatures, or as the church liked to put it, a rotten and putrid vessel of original sin, but are the majesty of God's creation, made in God's image, and therefore equal in dignity and by logic in rights. Now, these aren't original ideas. They pervaded Enlightenment thinking. They helped, needless to say, shape the American Revolution underway at this very moment. This essay I've talked about was written in 1777, and later the French Revolution as well. And even in Russia, these aren't completely original ideas. These were becoming increasingly familiar, especially to the growing number of educated Russians, especially Freemasons. What really is important about Novikov is not his originality as a thinker, but his ability to spread and popularize this Enlightenment humanism among Russia's growing class of the educated. This outlook of his, this moral outlook, would prove increasingly important in the 19th and even the 20th centuries. And in practice, his ability to spread these ideas among the educated was truly prodigious. In 1779, he moved to Moscow to take over the lease of Moscow University Press, at that point the most important publishing house in the country. After Catherine allowed in her new rule of 1783 individuals to set up private publishing houses, he did just that, set up a private publishing and printing firm, mostly with his Masonic friends, not, by the way, unlike the famous American Freemason and printer-publisher Benjamin Franklin. He also maintained on the side a secret printing press for publishing Masonic religious literature, but he became already, even without all this, Russia's biggest private publisher. He also continued to edit and contribute to various journals, many of which he himself published. He also actively promoted a book trade in Russia to make sure that his various books could find readers all over the country again. No one had done anything like this before. He became Russia's first great book trader as well. He also published children's books, and not surprising, with the same basic ideas about the dignity of the individual were embedded in these very ideas written for, these books written for children. And on top of all that, during a terrible famine that took place in 1787, he began to organize a major philanthropic campaign of relief effort, becoming the first and important philanthropist in Russia as well. Now, Novikov was not alone in any of these efforts, but as the most visible figure in the development of this independent cultural life, this independent public opinion standing outside the bounds of the state, he can be seen in many ways as standing truly in the forefront of something important and new in Russia, the emerging public sphere. You could see it in publishing, the book trade, journalism, philanthropy. In the emerging intelligentsia, this people who criticized based on ideal principles. All of this was still partial, still tentative, but really beginning, and Novikov stands very much at the center and is an exemplar of all this. Now, Catherine the Great grew increasingly nervous about all of this independence, and she was especially suspicious of Freemasons. She wrote stories and brochures making fun of Freemasons, calling them a bunch of obscurantists, mystics with really bizarre ideas who lost touch with reason. After the French Revolution, this became no joking matter. French Masons played a leading role in the French Revolution, as they had in the American Revolution before that. She decided the time had come to take decisive action before the Masons presented the same threat to her as they seemed to do in other countries. 1792, she had Novikov arrested and condemned as a subversive without trial whatsoever, and sentenced to 15 years in the Schlüsselburg fortress, one of the most fearsome fortresses for prisoners near St. Petersburg. His publishing house was closed. Many of his books were burned. He personally emerged from all this 4 years later, amnestied at the start of the reign of Paul, not because Paul was more liberal, but because Paul hated his mother and was determined to do everything to undo what she had accomplished. He came out truly broken physically and financially, and tended to seek a comfort primarily in mysticism. He spent, in fact, the final years of his life preparing a huge anthology of mystical, theosophical, magical, and Kabbalistic writings. Now, however personally sad this end might seem, and has seemed to many who have written about him, in fact, and this may sound harsh historically, is historically, this really was of little significance. Though, of course, it does reveal how strong religion was always in his critical moral vision. It's insignificant historically because the fact is Catherine couldn't stop what she had, ironically, herself helped to encourage, the emergence of a vibrant, independent, critically minded intellectual life in Russia. She couldn't stop that. She couldn't stop the development of this very important public sphere with its own organizations, its own opinions, this creation of a public with a public opinion. And least of all could she stop the most dangerous element of that, which would become so important into the 19th century. She couldn't stop the emergence of an intelligentsia. Critically minded Russians, morally driven, educated, who were determined to devote themselves to serving their nation, not by serving the state, not by serving in the military, but in more independent ways, the way Novikov was really the first and most important to do so. And indeed, many would take things much further than Novikov himself did. Now, when looking at all this, Catherine might have said of Novikov and of the emergence of this intelligentsia pretty much the same as what she said about Pugachev and his ideals. It's nothing but castles in the air. And again, she probably would have been right. And indeed, as time goes on, we'll see the extent to which these dreams often were so hard to realize. But what she was wrong about and misunderstood was how powerful just these dreams were. These dreams of castles in the air, of a moral, just society would prove to have an enormous power over the rest of Russian history down till the present day to inspire people, to mobilize them, and increasingly to subvert the status quo, especially when people saw that status quo as restrictive and oppressive. Next time, we'll look at a different dreamer, another monarch, with his own visions of transforming Russia into a more modern, more just society.
Lecture 7, Alexander I, Imagining Reform.
In the last few lectures, we've looked already at the growing tensions visible in 18th century Russian political culture between widespread desires, especially among the elites, especially among governmental elites, for thoroughgoing westernization and modernization of their society, and the persistent belief, on the other hand, in the importance of a strong central state precisely to realize these goals. Increasingly, especially by the 18th century, this first belief in westernizing, modernizing reform tended to threaten the second, the idea of autocracy and absolute power. And in fact, anxieties in the state about the dangers of too much reform, already seen quite visibly toward the end of Catherine the Great's reign, became especially visible in the final reign of the 18th century, in fact, the one that inaugurated the new 19th century. And this was the brief, indeed only four-year-long rule, of Catherine the Great's son, Paul, or Pavel in Russian, who ruled from 1796 to 1801. In practice, Paul actually had relatively little impact on Russian politics. What really makes his reign interesting is the symbolism, what it tells us about Russia's changing political culture. And one could see this in not just what he did, though this is important, but even more in the way upper-class society reacted to his actions. And this lecture begins with Paul's brief but revealing reign, and then turns its attentions to his son, Alexander I, a ruler in many ways who truly and most deeply embodied all the contradictions of the age, as a result of which many began to call him Russia's Sphinx. Now, briefly put, Paul I, sought to undo as much of his mother's work as possible. We already saw him release Novikov from prison, just partly as a way of spiting his now deceased mother. But even more substantially, but still symbolically, he signaled his distance from his mother, his hostility from his mother, by having Peter III, his widely despised, his murdered father, dug up from his rather modest resting place and reburied with great pomp and ceremony. In terms of ideology and policy, it's clear that Paul was, above all, deeply suspicious, indeed really hostile, to the independent social activity that was especially visible among the nobility. He, first of all, immediately revoked the charter of the nobility, Catherine the Great's charter, which really enshrined Peter III's decision to free nobles from service and encourage them to engage in alternative forms of public service. He truly feared what these nobles were doing out there on their estates, what they were doing when they weren't in state service where they could be watched and controlled, what they were doing when they weren't in the military. So he forced nobles back into mandatory service and, in fact, took away all their involvement in running local affairs, the very thing Catherine the Great was trying to encourage. He also, for the exact same reason, revoked the Charter of Towns, which also gave local notables in the cities an opportunity to manage in a semi-autonomous way local affairs. His ideal for Russian life can be summed up really in a single word: militarization. Personally, he was absolutely obsessed with all things military, and his notion of the military was really quite a Prussian one. He spent a huge amount of time redesigning uniforms, redesigning regulations, organizing drills, organizing parades, all on a Prussian model. And most of all, he loved to engage in constant marches through the main squares of Petersburg and Moscow. So bad had this obsession with marching troops back and forth, and they looked quite beautiful, but still it became too much, that many critics began to speak of a paradomania with Paul. And in fact, as much as possible, he tried to apply these military methods to government as well. Also, to try to ensure a truly martial spirit in Russian life, one might describe it even as a sort of macho spirit in Russian life, he made sure that women, like Catherine the Great herself, would never have a chance to legally rule in Russia again. And indeed, part of this may have been just his own spite about his mother, but it was also a sense that men should rule in the future. And he declared a new law of succession that restored primogeniture in the male line. It was also in conformity with that of most other monarchies in Europe, but in violation of Peter the Great's idea that the monarch should have the power to choose the person most qualified with the most merit to rule. In other words, Paul tried to revive the tradition of the all-powerful, dominating autocrat, ruling according totally to his personal will and whim, the idea of the Grozny Tsar, but also one with a measure of regularity, hence the primogeniture rule. This is all especially visible, by the way, in his personal style, this sense of him as a Grozny Tsar, as a true, mighty, and awesome autocrat. Except in not the impressive way of the awesomeness, for example, of Ivan IV. In fact, historians have often talked about Paul with terms not like awesome, but more such as capricious. neurotic, manic. In fact, one well-known historian has even referred to Paul as nothing less than a crowned psychopath. And it's well known that Paul had a brutal manner, a strong temper. He often engaged in humiliating and brutal outbursts against people in court, against officials, indeed reminding one, and indeed reminding many Russians, of Peter the Great with his club, except there seemed to be no rhyme or reason as to whom he would lash out against. In fact, he was especially known and feared for frequent dismissals of people from their office, which would be often followed immediately by exile to Siberia. Sometimes this would be right on the parade ground. He didn't like the way an officer was moving or how he led his troops. He would immediately march up to him, declared him dismissed, ordered guards to take him to Siberia. So much had this become part of his reputation, many officers were known to always keep money on hand just in case. Less harmful, but no less degrading, he also forbade all the inhabitants of St. Petersburg to harness more than 2 horses to their carriages. He, of course, often had 3 horses and wanted to make sure that there was a distance between him and any ordinary mortal that might be seen in his vicinity. He also, even more humiliating, required that when his carriage approached in the streets or when he was passing in any way, that everybody stop their carriages, get out, stand on the ground, and bow before him. All of which was particularly degrading and demeaning, especially in the times of year when the streets, which were made of dirt mostly, were quite muddy. Nonetheless, aristocrats had to get down and bow before Paul. He also hated and feared everything associated with France, which he considered to be the land of revolution, and everything about it to somehow be, by definition, revolutionary. And therefore, he banned all French fashions, or French-style fashions, in Russia. Round hats, which were popular in France at the time, were out. Long trousers were forbidden. We're talking about the elite here, of course. One had to wear the short culottes. And, of course, long trousers reminded one of the radicalism of the sans-culottes in France, the lower and middle class rebels who were actually called sans-culottes, people without culottes, and therefore he wanted to make sure such things, revolutionary long pants, wouldn't be worn by the Russian elite. He also complained about the way women wore their ribbons in their hair, again, seen as something that seemed rather to smell of France and hence revolution, or even certain hairstyles were banned. He also banned in a more substantive way foreign books, foreign travel, even certain words were considered to be somehow subversive by their very foreignness. At the same time, he was, and again part of a familiar Russian tradition, a very religious man. He saw himself as a Christian ruler, as a caring ruler, as the father to his people. Now, all of this is interesting and revealing in its own way, but what's really telling is how elite society reacted to all this. They made it clear they were not going to take this anymore. This was not the sort of rule or style of rule that they could any longer tolerate. They had come a long way, the aristocrats of Russia, from the sort of servile cringing before the Tsar, such as was typical of their Muscovite ancestors. Whatever the Tsar did, however intolerable he was, one bowed down and accepted it. They refused to return to this uncivilized, demeaned, and as they saw it, completely un-Western, uncivilized a status. And therefore, when, as you can probably already predict, Paul was deposed and murdered by palace guards in a coup in March of 1801, the response among the upper elite was really, in many ways, almost obscene joy. Likewise, when Alexander I, Paul's oldest son, who ruled from 1801 to 1825, came to the throne, this was met with widespread jubilation and high hopes, especially, again, we're talking about elite society. And these hopes were encouraged in many ways by Alexander I himself. On coming to the throne, Alexander made it clear that, unlike his father, he would rule in the spirit of his grandmother, Catherine II. He also, implicitly, in the closed circles of the elite, made it clear that he approved of the coup against his father. He did make it clear that he did not know that they were going to murder him. One can question whether that was true or not. But nonetheless, his acceptance of this act indicated his own acceptance of the idea that tyranny was now illegitimate, an illegitimate form of power. Practically, he did undid much of his father's what might be best called his counter reforms, except, interestingly enough, the rule of succession along the male line, which seemed to him to be fair and rational and following Western models. And he set out on a course of trying to further Catherine's reforms. Now, let me caution you here. In many ways, Alexander I is one of the most complex and intriguing and difficult to understand monarchs in modern Russia. He was a challenge for his contemporaries to figure out. He was a challenge for his friends to understand, and he remains a challenge for historians. He's been called variously a sphinx due to all of this complexity, an enigma, and even by some a crowned Hamlet. What I'd like to suggest, and I'll elaborate on this, is that Alexander's seeming contradictoriness, his strangeness, had much to do with the contradictoriness that we've already discussed about the Russian political tradition. The dual tradition of the Tsar being both Grozny and Tishaishi, both awesome and fierce and guarding the absolute power of the throne on the one hand, and also tender and saintly and loving and caring for the people's happiness on the other. First, an overview of his major acts. He began his reign very promisingly by establishing what he called an unofficial committee. And the job of this committee, which was made up of people he knew well, closely respected, generally people seen as having enlightened views about politics and society, he brought these people together to discuss really thinking about major political and social reforms, including nothing less than creating a constitution for Russia, something that in some ways would limit the absolute personal power of the autocrat, at least in law, and, very importantly, in social affairs, an end to serfdom. And in fact, throughout his reign, he continued to talk about the possibility of creating a constitution for Russia. He also reformed the central state administration by giving the Senate, and the Senate was this body created by Peter I, which was mainly made up of the heads of the colleges, of the ministries, as well as other high expert advisors who served the Tsar as advisor, Alexander made the Senate even more powerful an institution for coordinating policy, and also it would serve as the first Supreme Court for the country. He also actually changed the name of the colleges into ministries and reorganized their structure. The collegiate leadership of the colleges, which was collaborative among a small committee, was seen as inefficient, as not sufficiently in tune with what existed in Western Europe at that point, and created ministries, each of which had one single minister in charge. He also created a new central institution, which was called the State Council. This was modeled explicitly on Napoleon's Conseil d'État, his own council of state, and this was made up of respected advisors, experts in various fields, who could advise him on reform, even after the unofficial committee ceased to exist. He also enacted some legislation to try to, at least while thinking about what to do with serfdom, would at least improve the conditions of serfs. Most importantly, he forbid for the first time the selling of individual serfs apart from their families. He also, as his predecessors had done, especially Catherine and Peter, tried to encourage the economy. And one way he did it was to allow non-nobles to own estates, that anybody who seemed to have the money and the desire to build up agriculture, and often factories in those lands, could now own land, own estates. He also tried to expand education and culture in his country by establishing four new universities, and the most important of which was in St. Petersburg, where he took Peter the Great's smaller school connected to the Academy of Sciences and really transformed it into a modern Western-style university, much more like Moscow University had been. He also established schools throughout the country, including for peasants, and he gave to both teachers in local schools as well as to the universities even more autonomy than they ever had before. However, there's something else going on that's important to think about in understanding Alexander. On the one hand, there was a lot of talk, as we've seen, about constitutional reform. He established various committees to study the matter. He even corresponded with people like Thomas Jefferson about models for a Russian constitution, figuring Jefferson would have useful advice based on his American experience, also seen in some ways as comparable in terms of a monarchical society creating a more democratic one, but with a strong state. And during the war with Napoleon, he constantly talked about this war as freeing Europe from tyranny, bringing greater constitutional freedom to Europe. And yet, nothing was ever done about a constitution, about ending serfdom, other than talk. He just talked all the way to the end of his reign about it. And there's a lot of explanations for why he never acted, why he never realized the promises he seemed to begin with. One of them was his distraction, as it was said, with international affairs, especially the ongoing conflict with Napoleonic France, first from 1805 to 1807, and then after a period of peace, again with Napoleon's invasion of Russia from 1812 to 1814. This was a war that included terrible setbacks, most famously the burning of Moscow itself in 1812, occupied by Napoleonic troops and indeed by Napoleon. But it also included great victories. Most notably, at the end of all of this, Russian troops marching all the way across Europe into Paris itself in 1814. Again, making clear to the world that Russia was truly a European great power. But other reasons may explain his failure to act. Political unrest in Europe seemed to frighten him. In particular, in 1820, a number of liberal revolutions broke out in places like Greece and Spain, making him feel that liberal ideas could unleash a type of disorder that was dangerous. The influence of the conservative Austrian foreign minister, Prince von Metternich, was also seen as helping to convince him of the dangers of liberalism. He also, it is said, may have been unwilling to alienate the nobility, hence his fear of ending serfdom. He needed this class still. They were the ruling class of Russia. Another explanation was his growing personal mysticism, which I'll talk more about. His sense that there was a better world, but it would only exist not on Earth. There have also been less charitable arguments about his failure to act. Some have said it's simply duplicity. He wanted to please people, especially people in the upper classes. So he pretended to be more liberal, or even vanity. He wanted to be admired as a wise and enlightened man. Some said just like his grandmother, who never really believed these things. It's also significant that Alexander did more than just fail to produce a constitution. He also vigorously opposed proposals, mainly coming from the nobility, to give real legislative power to the Senate. He silenced, in fact, proponents of just this proposal, a group known as the Senatorial Party, or that's what they were later called, who believed the Senate should be a true legislative body. And in fact, not only did he reject this, but as many historians have noted, he had, as one put it, an almost pathological suspicion of anyone who might try to limit autocratic power. Now, how does one reconcile these two sides of his policies? To do so, I think one has to look more closely at his ideas about power. First, there's good reason to see his enlightened talk as serious and sincere. Everything we know about him suggests that he took the lessons of the Enlightenment deeply to heart. It pervaded his education, which was, by the way, personally overseen by Catherine the Great herself, who distrusted what Paul might do in educating young Alexander. Catherine personally met with him and laid out the principles for an ideal ruler. High virtue, in particular, the Stoic principles of reserve and self-control. She argued and taught Alexander that only when people control their animal instincts would rulers be able to be guided by the voice of reason, hence be superior to common people, hence have the right to rule. She also advised him to avoid the sort of brutal, commanding, military persona of the ruler. She said he should be, as a ruler, mild, these are her words, humane, accessible, compassionate. In other words, the Enlightenment version of the ideal Tishaishi Tsar. Alexander's primary tutor also elaborated on these messages. He was a Swiss philosopher, a professed republican named Frederick César de la Harpe, personally chosen by Catherine, and he constantly instructed Alexander in the ideals of a virtuous ruler guided by reason. In fact, the model he was taught was to emulate the great Greek philosopher king Marcus Aurelius. Laharpe also taught Alexander about the importance of a civil society, a society that respected the natural equality of human beings, in which a monarch exists above all for the good of his people, and the people have a place to participate. Laharpe had Alexander read all the great works of the Enlightenment, as well as classics to learn these ideas. And Alexander also had a special religious instructor, a secularized Russian priest from England, who taught him a basically personal and sort of universal faith. The idea that religion was for the salvation not of any one country, but of the world as a whole, and that God above all wished people to be happy. It's clear Alexander took all these lessons to heart. He reflected them when he first came to power, when he tried to express the idea that he intended to be a virtuous ruler. In fact, in his manifesto that announced the beginning of his reign, he emphasized that above all he had kind intentions to make his people happy. Similarly, official praise of Alexander often liked to talk about him as an angel. Poetry written in his honor talked about his great gentleness. And in fact, later in his reign, especially after his victory over Napoleon, rather than suggest that he be called Alexander the Great, this seemed too martial for him. They suggested, and they knew he would prefer, to be offered the title of Alexander the Blessed. He declined it, by the way. He said it seemed inappropriate. He said in the name of modesty and humility, he couldn't accept such a title. All of this, you of course recognize, resembles this old ideal of the Tsar as Tishaishi, the loving Tsar, but now painted in the Enlightenment colors of the virtuous Enlightenment ruler. There was another side to his personality. Alexander also loved all things military, like his father. In fact, his teachers had no understanding of all of this. He would sometimes neglect his duties in order to engage in various military activities. He loved drilling troops in preparation for a grand parade. He liked redesigning uniforms, though his tastes appropriately were French rather than Prussian. He loved watching the ceremonial changing of the guard, and he made them more elaborate so he could enjoy them even more. And he was personally involved in war itself, took an active role in the war against Napoleon. How does one reconcile this combination of blessed angel and passionate soldier? One gets some help in this when one looks at the third indication of his ideas about power, how he thought about the very meaning of the word constitution. It's clear that what he did not mean was the idea of balancing and limiting the power of the executive with an elected legislator, an elected legislative branch with real powers. He didn't believe in the separation and balance of powers, of checks on executive power. What constitution meant to Alexander and most of his close associates was an orderly system of administration and law, free from arbitrariness, free from tyranny, but still strong. In other words, he wanted a rational government, not a democratic government. And in many ways, his main idea here was the German notion I've mentioned before of a Rechtsstaat, a state based on law, rationalized, written procedures, clear division of functions. For him, this was the key to political happiness of the whole nation. Hence, he must reject more radical demands that limited this creative power, though bound by law. In other words, what might appear as jealous protection of his power as an autocrat was in many ways, and it's clear that for him this was true, of a strong conviction shared by a lot of his enlightened predecessors that autocracy was the guarantor of Russia's happiness. It guaranteed order, which was seen as associated with happiness. It guaranteed that there would be a force for bringing about changes, a force that would be free from the particularistic interests of aristocrats and free of the backward ideas of ordinary people, a dynamic, enlightened force for change. In real life, though, matters were not always so simple. In the final years of Alexander's reign, there were signs that he was losing confidence in this rationalistic faith in how order would somehow lead to happiness. And he began to express, especially to those clear to him, growing doubts that human beings could ever make the world a better place. In fact, he began in many ways to look more and more like a crowned Hamlet, as it was said of him, wringing his hands over suffering and evil in the world, and above all, over his own inabilities to really make life better, whether as a mighty, powerful Grozny Tsar, or even, as was more his instincts, as a gentle, caring, loving Tishaishi Tsar. These doubts were reinforced as he began to travel around Russia. Here, he witnessed firsthand the real sufferings of his people, the real backwardness of his country, even of many of the nobles who weren't in Petersburg or Moscow, but lived back in their states. Backward, poor, suffering. And he really wondered whether there was anything a mere czar could do to change people, to change conditions in a way that would truly bring happiness. The optimism of his early years was clearly beginning to fade. These doubts were, of course, reinforced by his growing religious mysticism. And vice versa, this mysticism reinforced his doubts. During the Napoleonic Wars in particular, Alexander became what might be called reborn as a Christian. Indeed, he spoke often as if he had just been converted to Christianity, something he hadn't fully understood before. As a result, he became more pious, practicing religion more intensely, more engaged in prayer, and more mystical in his way of thinking about what it was he was doing. Public prayer, religious ceremony became more and more part of his reign. And he also began to talk more and more about how religious faith, rather than secular changes in the world, was really the only and certainly the best way to ensure people's happiness. He wasn't sure they could be happy on this world. He began to talk more and more about they could certainly and probably only be happy in the next. And the key moment in what might be called his existential crisis, undermining the sort of optimism that truly drove rulers like Peter the Great and Catherine the Great before him, this key moment was a terrible, terrible flood that occurred nearly at the end of his reign in St. Petersburg in 1824. This was common. The city often had flooded. Peter the Great had built the city on the edge of a sea in a swampy area in which it was not unusual for the winds and the rising waters to drown St. Petersburg. And this is what happened in 1824. And for a lot of observers, especially at this time, in this really one of the worst floods, indeed the worst flood in a century in the city, since the city had been created, was seen as a sort of failure of rationalism, a sort of failure of the limited power of human beings to control nature, to impose order on the world, the very thing Petersburg was meant to symbolize. And we don't actually know what Alexander thought as he traveled about the city and viewed this horrific disaster, which drove people out of their homes, drowned many. We do know that he did travel about the city, and that at one point he had his carriage stop on a high point where he could see the entire devastation before him, climbed out of his carriage, gazed at this disaster, and according to all reports, wept at that moment. I don't think it's too fanciful to suggest that these were what might be described as philosophical tears. Tears of disappointment. Tears of deep existential doubts about the capacity of human beings to change the world. As well as a sort of the tears of the type of angelic sympathy for which he was known. Next time, we look at different voices of disappointment, even disappointment in Alexander himself. At idealistic noblemen who were disappointed above all by the failed promises of Alexander's reign, by his own optimistic moves toward reforming, modernizing the state, and ending serfdom. And they, in this case, decided to take unprecedented public action to really change Russia.
Lecture 8, The Decembrist Rebellion.
Last time, we talked about Emperor Alexander I's efforts, uncertain, contradictory efforts in many ways, in the early 1800s to try to continue to ensure Russia's political modernization, westernization, even to the point of talking openly about constitutionalism and ending serfdom. In this lecture, we'll be talking about an event that may be seen in many ways as a direct result of these efforts, as well as the failure to produce any real results. This was an unprecedented armed uprising led by Russian noblemen known as the Decembrist Rebellion. And this was a rebellion not just for the power of their own particular class, hence very different from the Guards' rebellions in the past, which were usually self-interested efforts by the aristocracy. This was a rebellion for democratic ideals, something truly new. Now, this rebellion occurred in the midst of a succession crisis, which took place after Alexander I, who had no children of his own, unexpectedly died in November of 1825. What resulted was a great deal of public confusion over who would now take the throne. Would it be Alexander's elder brother Constantine? According to the succession law that Paul instituted, this, of course, would be what was expected. And indeed, everybody did expect it. Or, as it seemed to be happening, would it be Alexander's younger brother, indeed youngest brother, Nicholas? And this was what was publicly announced, which confused everybody. The reason it was announced was for the simple reason, though this part was not publicized, since it was seen as slightly embarrassing, that Constantine had a couple of years earlier renounced his rights to the throne after he married a Polish aristocrat who was not of noble blood. Rather, not of royal blood. And the problem, though, was not just uncertainty and the confusion of who was going to inherit the throne. Part of the problem was also that Nicholas was widely viewed as a reactionary, whereas Constantine, who should have inherited according to the law, except that he renounced it, was widely viewed as a more liberal, westernizing individual. However, part of what was going on at this point was simply that the succession crisis proved as an opportune moment to take some action, to take advantage of the confusion. And this was done by a group of liberal-minded aristocrats, mostly officers from the army, who were members of a secret political society located in St. Petersburg, known as the Northern Society, who had made plans already to try to seize power in an armed insurrection. This seemed like the perfect moment. This revolution, as it might be called, was to take place, as they planned it, on December 14th, 1825, the date that was selected for swearing allegiance to the new Tsar, Nicholas. December 14th, 1825, of course, was on the Russian calendar. Europe was 12 days later. The scene of the action was Senate Square in St. Petersburg, appropriately chosen, not only a good place for troops to gather, but the place with a statue of the great reformer, Peter the Great, built by the next great reformer, Catherine the Great, stood. Things did not go well. Several of the leaders of this rebellion got cold feet and didn't show up at the square at all. For example, a prince named Trubetskoy, a leader of the Northern Society, an officer in the army, who was given the job of commanding the whole insurrection and then was to become head of the new revolutionary government, never even showed up at Senate Square. He was found, in fact, later that night, hiding in the Austrian embassy. His lieutenant, a colonel named Bulatov, behaved really even more tragically. He at least had the courage to show up at the square, but when he got there, seeing what was going on around him, seeing this moment of rebelliousness, he had a change of heart, went to the Tsarist military headquarters, and swore an oath of allegiance to Nicholas. And then, realizing what he had just done, he announced he actually didn't mean to swear the oath to Nicholas at all, but in fact he really wanted to kill Nicholas as a potential tyrant for which he was arrested. He was sent to prison and there committed suicide. This general lack of leadership left on the square a handful of officers who were either unwilling or unable to take command of the insurrection and a few thousand soldiers. who were brought there by their officers, but in fact who knew relatively little of what the whole rebellion was supposed to be about or what they were supposed to do. It happened that the plan was to surround the Senate building, which would have been pointless since it was empty, and then to seize the Winter Palace and arrest Nicholas, which would have also been pointless since he wasn't there. All in all, this is not a very impressive revolution for what is often in history called Russia's first revolution. Its main signs were poor planning, confusion, and even a good deal of cowardice, if not tragic confusion. This was not the case on the government side. The new Tsar, Nicholas I, immediately ordered his troops to repress the rebellion with force, and they did so, though not without some resistance, indeed even including the killing of a government official sent to the square to quell the rebel troops by one of the officers who ran up to him and shot him dead. This rebellion also had echoes in other parts of the country besides St. Petersburg, and the most important of those was in Ukraine, where it was led, this movement was led by another secret society with very close ties to the Petersburg Northern Society, and this one was called the Southern Society. For several days, rebel troops, led by rebel officers, and the soldiers followed along, were on the march from Ukraine, heading up toward St. Petersburg, where they intended to come to the aid of the rebellion that took place there, which had already failed, and help bring about a more democratic government, as I'll describe in a moment. This, too, was crushed by troops sent to quell the rebellion and arrest its leaders. In fact, the leaders who were arrested were severely punished by the new Tsar. After a trial, 125 men were sentenced to hard labor or exile, and five of the leaders, all of them very high-born aristocrats, were publicly executed, hanged. Things could, it should say, have been worse. The new emperor, Nicholas I, wanted to show some mercy. This was, after all, the very beginning of his reign, virtually the first act he undertook. And originally, the five leaders of the rebellion who were sentenced to death were sentenced to be, like Pugachev, drawn and quartered in a public square. Nicholas mercifully reduced this simply to hanging. Now, what did these rebels want? After all, remember, they're all privileged young nobles and officers. Part of the answer can be found by looking at the programs that they drew up before the rebellion. In particular, a program called, in this case, one of them was called the Constitution, and this was written by members of the Northern Society in St. Petersburg. And another program of ideas known as the Russian Law, written by the leader of the Southern Society. First of all, in both of these programs, and in other statements that one sees from these Decembrist rebels, as they began to be known, a strong state was seen as essential for progress. And here, in fact, one sees a rather important consistency with the traditions of reform in the Tsarist state itself. The most moderate of the Decembrist programs was the Constitution, written primarily by a man named Nikita Muravyov, for the Northern Society. And this envisioned a Russia that would be ruled after a period of temporary dictatorship to ensure order, that would be ruled by a hereditary monarch. This remained a monarchy. However, it was seen not a very rational term, monarch or czar or emperor. He was to be called supreme functionary, a more modern and rational notion, but still hereditary. It was seen as more orderly. But more importantly, he would share his power with an elected legislature, very much designed on the United States model, which these rebels greatly admired. But together, this hereditary monarch, the supreme functionary, and this elected legislature would still form a strong central authority, hearing the voice of the people, balanced with the legislature, but nonetheless very strong at the center. And by the way, many of these rebels were very interested in U.S. democracy, and as they read the American tradition, especially Hamiltonian aspects of it, they saw this as part of the American logic as well. Strong government with a legislative presence. A much more radical program came from the hand of Pavel Pistel, the leader of the Southern Society based in Ukraine, and this was what's called the Russian Law. This title is actually quite interesting. In Russian, it is Ruskaya, which means Russian, Pravda. And this Russian word Pravda is a complicated word. In part, it means law, but it also means truth, and it also means justice. And embedded in the title alone, one can see the sense that there are universal truths, universal standards that need to be applied to a country. Concretely, what Pestel had in mind was an even stronger state than envisioned in the Constitution Muravyov wrote for the Northern Society. In his view, for 10 years after the revolution, there would be a very strong dictatorship, one that could bring about major changes in society. And even after that, a very centralized authoritarian state would exist, though entirely democratic, not even a supreme functionary whose power came through heredity. The logic in all of this was clear and fairly typical of Russian thought, though not unique to Russia. Namely, the idea that only a powerful, centralized state could ensure Russia's progress. And this is what needs to be emphasized. Progressive change was really the point here. The Decembrists made it clear that their goal was to really increase citizenship. This was the heart of their idea. And this meant, above all for them, the rights of individuals. In many ways, these were Western liberals, strongly influenced by Western ideas. In all their programs, they talked about the absolute essential nature of having basic civil rights, freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, and not surprisingly, and not uniquely, they were vehemently opposed to serfdom, the ultimate violation of the freedom and dignity of the individual. Now, these programs, these first formal manifestos for radical change coming from the Decembrists, are, of course, important. But they really only tell us something about the outward forms of this Decembrist movement. They really tell us little about human meanings, about deeper ideas, about how these ideas grew out of their lives, and what these things meant as feelings and visions of transforming Russia. And to give you some idea of this more human level of the meaning of the Decembrist rebellion, I want to spend the rest of the time with really one single Decembrist, an important one, a man whose name was Nikolai Turgenev, born in 1789, the very moment of the French Revolution, died in 1871. He was one of the organizers of the Northern Society, and of a whole series of secret societies in St. Petersburg that had preceded it. In 1826, for his role as one of the leaders of the Northern Society, which was the main instigator of the rebellion on Senate Square, he was sentenced to be decapitated. In fact, however, he took no part in the actual uprising. He had actually left Russia a year before, a fact which, needless to say, saved his life. It also prevented him from returning home ever again. Although it's worth noting that in 1855, he was pardoned by Alexander II, he chose to remain in Western Europe at that point. Now, one of the reasons Turgenev is so especially interesting, besides being a leader of the Northern Society and one of its leading thinkers, is that he kept an extensive diary of his thoughts and experiences throughout his life. A diary which was written, I should note, not just in Russian, but in French, in English, and in German, reflecting how thoroughly westernized the elite had become, even in his private thoughts, he wrote in multiple languages. First thing to keep in mind is that Turgenev, and this applies to the other Decembrists as well, did not suffer socially or materially in Russia in any way. In fact, they were among its most privileged citizens. They were generally members of the nobility, often the highest ranks of the nobility. They were well-educated, they were young, they had good careers ahead of them. For example, Pavel Pestel, the fairly radical leader of the Southern Society, was the son of an official in the government who became Governor General of Siberia, one of the most powerful government officials, and himself was a colonel in the army. Turgenev, the man I want to focus on, was an up-and-coming government official during Alexander I's reign. Though he was a young man, only in his 20s, he was already a member of the very powerful State Council, this body of expert advisors, and he was head of a department within the Ministry of Finance. And indeed, had he not been a Decembrist rebel, it is probably likely he would have eventually been the Minister of Finance. He had a very good education in finance and economics as well. Notwithstanding all this privilege, all this comfort, all this possibility for personal success within the Russian system, Turgenev, like many other young noblemen, was profoundly discontented and frustrated and angry. One cause of this discontent was Alexander I himself. Like many Russians, Turgenev was filled with hopes when Alexander I came to power. He was excited by Alexander's promises that he would rule in the spirit of his grandmother, Catherine the Great. He deeply believed that Alexander's unofficial committee, known very well, indeed all of its members were known very well to those in the elite like Turgenev, he was convinced this was a clear sign Alexander was determined to do what every westernized, liberal-minded Russian knew was necessary, create a constitution, a true rule of law, and end the abysmal and humiliating fact of serfdom. And indeed, this is what the unofficial committee talked about. He was also further encouraged during the Napoleonic Wars by Alexander's constant talk that this was a fight against tyranny to bring freedom to Europe. But instead of freedom for Russia, what Turgenev and his friends saw was growing conservatism. Like many educated Russians, Turgenev asked the question, did we free Europe in order ourselves to remain in chains? This disappointment is important, an important cause of the Decembrist Rebellion, an important sign of what it meant, why they acted in this way. But I think the story goes still deeper than that. Even without Alexander, many educated young Russians like Turgenev had begun to see the whole world differently, to expect more from the world, especially from Russia. And this wasn't just a matter of new ideas, though it was certainly that. In many ways, this was a matter of seeing the world differently, of feeling differently about the world. To understand what I mean here, one has to keep in mind that most of the future Decembrists had been to Western Europe. Many of them were officers in the Russian army as it marched westward across Europe all the way to Paris after the defeat of Napoleon. And they often remained in Paris after they got there in 1814, sometimes for months, sometimes even for a couple of years with the occupying army. Turgenev's experiences were a little different. He had been to Europe in an earlier period, though again, an experience shared with many other Russian aristocrats. He spent 4 years studying at university in the German town of Göttingen. This was from 1808 to 1812. But whether they were in Europe as soldiers or as students, it turns out that for Russians like Turgenev, the experience was remarkably similar. While there, they attended lectures at the university, even if they were soldiers occupying Paris. They read liberal books and newspapers, which were widespread. And generally, they imbibed the whole spirit of the Enlightenment, of Romanticism, of the French Revolution, all of which pervaded European life and thought at the time. Equally important, they saw a life such as they had never seen before. Turgenev, and he was not unusual, was absolutely amazed by the higher standard of living in Europe, even among the urban common people. Totally different from the dismal poverty he saw even in Russian cities. He was also struck by a radically different public life. He wrote in his diary, it absolutely shocked him to come from a country in which people walking around in public, even in big cities like Petersburg, were visibly distrustful, frightened, sullen. And here he's in Western Europe, everybody walks about seeming self-assured with a sense of their dignity and freedom. Western Europe felt so radically different than Russia. As a result of these personal contacts with Western Europe, elite young Russians like Turgenev felt deeply embarrassed about their country's backwardness, about its distance from European life.